The First World War had changed the status of the United States from a debtor nation to the position of the world's greatest creditor nation. The Depression put the business and finance of the United States completely into the hands of the men behind the Federal Reserve. During Senate hearings of the Federal Reserve System in 1931, Governor George Harrison, Strong's successor as governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, was asked about the relationship between the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the Money Committee of the Stock Exchange. Harrison said there was no relationship. Then he went on to admit that on various occasions that the Money Committee of the Stock Exchange advised the Federal Reserve Bank of New York on the state of the money situation and what they think the rate should be. In 1936, we had the undistributed profits tax, which contributed greatly to the recession of 1937. In 1938, United States Steel was going to pay a dividend of $5.61 a share. This was before taxes. Dividends are paid out of profits, then out of taxes. The government got everything. Dividends were zip, nothing. People keep the chickens, the government takes the eggs. In 1937, the American Federation of Investors compiled the taxes and common stock dividends for 150 companies. One of the companies had more than $5 billion in assets. The average dividends were $1.95 per share. The average total tax, federal, state, and local per share, was $2.62, or 34% more to the government than to the owners. Because at that time, interest on government bonds was not taxed, people were investing in bonds and not companies. We were nationalizing the savings of the nation, investing them in debt. Per capita public debt in 1938 was $532.65 per person. This was greater than the per capita public debt in Germany, Italy, and France. In 1940, the national debt alone, not including state and municipal debt, was 34% of the assessed value of every piece of real estate and personal property in the entire country. In 1938, per capita taxes in the United States was $108. Germany's was $110. At the time, we increased our debt and mortgaged our future faster and heavier than did Germany. In the four Hoover years from 1928 to 1932, national income produced averaged $60.8 billion. In the first 6 years of FDR, it averaged $57.6 billion. Per capita basis income for Hoover averaged $507. In the first 6 years under FDR, it was $452. The recession was due to a variety of causes stemming in the main from over-optimism, which led the government to curtail its expenditures too sharply. Well, at least Franklin Delano Roosevelt said that, speaking in 1937. The national debt in 1790 was $75,463,477 because Congress assumed the debts the states had run up during the Revolutionary War. The debt in 1860 was $65 million, but after the Civil War, it was $2.7 billion. By 1917, the debt level was only $3 billion. But after the war, it was $25.5 billion, and in 1919, it came down a little during the 1920s. Calvin Coolidge actually took in as much money as he spent during his entire term as president, and in 1931, the debt was $16 billion. Because of the New Deal, the debt grew to $50 billion by 1941. By 1945, it was $268.7 billion. During the rest of the 40s and most of the 50s, the debt rose only slightly. prior to fiscal 1982, the annual deficit never reached the $100 billion level. Since then, it has never been less. From 1990 to 1995, the domestic dollar increased by 40% as measured in the M1 supply. Dollar volume outside the United States increased by up to 75%. There are as many dollars held abroad as both currency and bank reserves as there are held in the United States. But the Banking Act of 1933 legislated that all profits of the Federal Reserve banks must go to the banks themselves. This meant that the government's share in the profits had been eliminated. What the heck, it was never observed anyway. So the Federal Reserve assets went from $143 million in 1913 to $45 billion in 1949. This $45 billion in assets went directly to the stockholders of the Federal Reserve. From 1913 to 1935, the Secretary of the Treasury and the Comptroller of Currency were members of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, but the Banking Act of 1935 excluded them. The Banking Act of 1935 also extended the terms of office of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors to 14 years or 3.5 times the length of a presidential term. This meant that a president assuming office who might be hostile to the board could not appoint a majority of it who might be hostile to the board and could not appoint a majority of it who would be favorable to him. Thus, a monetary policy inaugurated before a president came into the White House would go on regardless of his wishes. This act also repealed a good clause in the Glass-Steagall Banking Act of 1913, which prohibited a banking house from being on the stock exchange or involved in investment banking. This meant that a bank could not lend money to a corporation which it owned. Another hidden clause in the act provided for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation that provided $150 million to guarantee $15 billion worth of deposits. This increased the power of the big bankers over the small banks and gave them another excuse to investigate the smaller banks. Prior to 1935, the Federal Reserve banks could not make loans to industry, so the bankers simply clamped down on making loans until that clause was repealed. The 1935 Act allowed the Federal Reserve banks to loan money directly to industry, competing with member banks who could not possibly match their capacity in arranging large loans. In a free enterprise system, it is imperative that all lines of business be in private hands except the printing of currency and postage stamps. But then, according to Bernard Baruch, he said that we haven't had free enterprise in this country since the war. And he made that statement in 1936, so he was talking about World War I. In 1933, Roosevelt removed Mr. Humphreys from the Federal Trade Commission. Mr. Humphreys sued, and the case went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of Mr. Humphreys, who had been appointed to the Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Trade Commission was enacted during Wilson's time and provided that members might be removed only for specified acts, such as inefficiency or malfeasance in office. In 1933, FDR removed Mr. Humphreys because he said, "Your mind and my mind do not go along together on the question of policy." The court said that removing Mr. Humphreys from the commission was an unconstitutional exercise of executive power. The Executive Reorganization Bill, as proposed by the President's Committee in January and February of 1937, would have given the President all the power which the Supreme Court said he did not possess in the Humphreys case. The bill would have given the president and his successors complete control over the decisions, policies, acts, and judgments of the Interstate Commerce Commission and the Federal Trade Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, and all other quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial bodies established by Congress. Roosevelt forced the governor of the Farm Credit Administration, which was independently operated in large part by the farmers and invested by them, and Roosevelt turned it over to the politicians who farm the farmers. Secretary of the Navy in 1940, who was Charles Edison, proposed that the president be given war powers in peacetime, which meant he could seize factories and railroads, fix prices, wages, and thus regiment labor. Those were the same powers Hitler had. In 1935 and 36, federal judges issued some 1,600 injunctions preventing federal officers from carrying out federal laws. The Code of Federal Regulations, about to be issued in 1940 by the Government Printing Office, was in 17 volumes, averaging 1,100 pages per volume for a total of 19,000 pages. From March 14, 1936 to October 7, 1939, now that's only 3.5 years, there were 115 agencies of the federal government issuing 14,889 rules, regulations, and administrative decisions telling American businessmen how to operate. This covers only from June 1, 1938, and was exclusive, of course, of the United States statutes at large. It is the law written by downtown Washington after Congress goes home. Also in 1940, the Republican Party chose Wendell Willkie as their presidential candidate. Until he ran for president, he was a registered Democrat and an internationalist. A poll showed only 3% of the Republicans favored Willkie, yet he became their candidate. One Republican wrote an editorial asking, "We Republicans in the West want to know if Wall Street, the utilities, and the international bankers control our party and can select our candidate. I believe I am serving the best interest of the Republican Party by protesting in advance and exposing the machinations and attempts of J.P. Morgan and the New York utility bankers in forcing Wendell Willkie onto the Republican Party. There is nothing to the Willkie boom for president except the artificial public opinions being created by newspapers, magazines, and the radio. The reason back of all this is money. Money is being spent by someone, and lots of it." But Willkie didn't win, and after Willkie lost, he became an international emissary for FDR. James Warburg, Paul Warburg's son, was appointed Franklin Delano Roosevelt's director of the budget when the great man assumed office in 1933, and setting up the Office of War Information, or official propaganda agency, during the Second World War. In the First World War, the head of the British Admiralty and Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Navy were distant cousins. They were Winston Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, respectively. In World War II, they each were heads of state. Before we officially got involved in World War II, Hamilton Fish Armstrong, who was the Executive Director of Foreign Affairs, and Walter Mallory, the CFR's Executive Directors, met with Assistant Secretary of State George Messerschmitt and proposed that the CFR help the State Department plan and formulate wartime policy. The Assistant Chief of the Division of Spatial Research of the State Department resigned, stating, "Relations with the Council on Foreign Relations, I have been consistently opposed to every move tending to give it increasing control of the research of this division. And though you have also consistently stated that such a policy was far from your objectives, the actual facts already visibly show that departmental control is fast losing ground. In 1940, also a code clerk named Tyler Kent discovered secret dispatches between Churchill and FDR. This revealed FDR's plan to bring the United States into the war. He tried to smuggle some documents out of the embassy, hoping to alert the American people, but he was caught and confined to British prisons for the entire war. 83% of the American public were against us entering the European conflict unless there was an incident more insufferable than the Lusitania affair. FDR shipped 50 destroyers to Great Britain without congressional approval, sent hundreds of millions of ammunition rounds to Britain, ordered our ships to sail directly into the war zone, and closed all German consulates, occupied Iceland, and depth-charged U-boats. The Germans never retaliated. Harry Hopkins visited Churchill in January of 1941, and Churchill said in his book, The Great Alliance, that Hopkins told him that the president is determined that we shall win the war together. Make no mistake about it. He has sent me here to tell you that at all cost and by all means, he will carry you through no matter what happens to him. Also in the book, a man called Intrepid, that there were American-British staff talks begun the same month under utmost secrecy, meaning disclosure to the American public was to be prevented. If the isolationists had known the full extent of the secret alliance between the United States and Great Britain, their demands for the president's impeachment would have rumbled like thunder through the land. That's what Roosevelt's friendly biographer Robert Sherwood had to say in his book. Henry Stimson wrote in his diary that we face the delicate question of the diplomatic fencing to be done so as to be sure Japan is put into the wrong and makes the first bad move, overt move, and later he recorded that the question was how we should maneuver them, Japan that is, into the position of firing the first shot. We had already broken the radio code of Tokyo and knew the Japanese spies in Hawaii were informing Tokyo of the precise locations of U.S. warships docked at Pearl Harbor. Admiral Kimmel and General Short were charged with dereliction of duty because Pearl Harbor was caught, quote, quote, off guard. Admiral Kimmel had replaced Admiral Richards, who had been removed by FDR after protesting the president's order to base the Pacific Fleet in Pearl Harbor, where it was quite vulnerable to attack. Most of the island's air defenses were stripped or greatly reduced shortly before the raid. Admiral Kimmel and General Short sought court-martials so they could get a fair hearing, and in 1944, Congress mandated it. The defense attorneys dug up some of Washington's secrets, and the verdict was overturned. Kimmel was exonerated, and Short received a small reprimand. The Roosevelt administration suppressed the results, citing national security during wartime. Then a new inquiry was conducted, and several witnesses were persuaded to change their testimony and incriminating memoranda in the files of the Navy and War Departments were destroyed. The court-martial findings were buried in a 40-volume government report, and few Americans never knew the truth. When Poland was attacked by Germany, France and Britain declared war on Germany. Within the month, the Soviet Union invaded Poland, but neither the United States nor any of their allies complained. we entered the war on Britain's side, and after the war, Poland had been conquered and enslaved by the Soviets. Hjalmar Schacht resigned from the Reichsbank in 1930, protesting the American Young Plan to exact reparations. He backed Hitler and persuaded the Dresdner and Deutsche Bank to do the same. He became disillusioned with Hitler in 1938 and later joined the conspiracy against him. The National Socialist Party of Adolf Hitler gained 7,300,000 votes in the election of 1932 and gained 288 seats in the Reichstag. On January 30, 1933, President von Hindenburg appointed Hitler Chancellor of the German Reich. On March 24, 1933, the Reichstag voted 441-94 to give full emergency powers to the new Reich Chancellor, and the Weimar Republic ceased to exist. Hitler attacked unemployment on many different fronts. He took over government control of the money and capital markets under the head of his Central Reichsbank. Hitler nationalized the central bank, in a sense eliminating the Federal Reserve System. On May 31st, they issued 1 billion marks, paying 4.5% interest of short-term public works bills designated to pay for specific infrastructure projects. They were taken into the banking system and rediscounted indefinitely by the banks, which caused them to become part of the underlying basis for the nation's money supply, along with gold and foreign exchange and long-term government bonds. This did not duplicate America's greenbacks because it was not money in itself, but a promise to pay money, and it did add to Germany's national debt, but it did come close to being a greenback. This money substitute caused unemployment to drop from 6 million in 1933 down to 1 million by 1936. In 1933, 283,995 dwellings were built, along with thousands of miles of Autobahn highways. Hitler's economic turnaround for Germany was based on a preparation for war economy. When the British, French, and American economies revived, they too were based on preparation for war economy. Hitler began massive public works buildings things for people, highways, parks, on a much larger scale than Roosevelt and the NRA, which the Supreme Court found unconstitutional. Tax benefits for industry and agriculture were given, and also tax benefits for domestic help. Hitler instituted wage and price controls, evening out wage differentials between labor and management, and when bonus time came around, everyone was paid on a mandatory scale, not like is done in the United States. Corporate profits had to be loaned to the government, initially at 6% interest, then lowered to 4.5%. Marriage bonuses loans were up to 1,000 marks, and free national health insurance was instituted. Summer camps were built for all kids, nutrition programs instituted, education was made mandatory at a time when in the U.S. only 10% graduated from high school. He spent 1 billion marks worth of employment creation bills. Manufacturing and jobs were kept in Germany and exports supported, underwritten by credit lines, financed by corporate taxes. Corporate profits quadrupled because of this, while wages and standard of living went up 16%. Simultaneously, Germany built the largest army in the world. Perhaps not the best thing, but considering Stalin was a neighbor, perhaps understandable. By 1938, there was a labor shortage in Germany, while America and Britain were sinking in debt and deep in depression. Germany had a generous Social Security retirement system. Then, on March 24, 1933, the London Daily Express had the following headline: Judea declares war on Germany. Jews of all the world unite. This was followed by the Israelite people of the entire world declare economic and financial war on Germany. 14 million Jews stand as one body to declare war on Germany. The Jewish wholesale dealer leaves his business, the banker his bank, the shopkeeper his shop, the beggar his miserable hut in order to combine forces in the holy war against Hitler's people. Germany is our public enemy number one. It is our object to declare war without mercy against her. The first boycott of the Jewish business concerns came after the Jewish declaration of war, but our Jewish interests demand Germany's total destruction collectively and individually. Even if Hitler, at the last moment, would want to avoid war, which would destroy him, he will, in spite of his wishes, be compelled to wage war. This was also the time the German government was removing Jews from influential positions and transferring power back to the German people. Then in 1937, Hermann Abs was the chairman of the Deutsche Bank. Well, this is going to do it for us today. I hope you'll be here with me on our next program. I'm going to take a little break from the Second World War and talk about Giannini, the founder of the Bank of Italy, which became the Bank of America. I think you'll find it informative and hope you'll think it's entertaining. Until then, this is the old Scotchman saying so long for now.